Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Steve Clemens, who is a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, he served as executive director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clemens.
Thank you, Ian. Great to be with you.
And obviously with the report from the computer security company Mandiant, which was covered extensively by the New York Times, the Chinese government's been sort of put on notice or caught red-handed, not that this was in any ways any breaking news that the Chinese military are involved in cyber espionage. I guess just to set the stage, if you will, what we're talking about here is cyber espionage in a kind of Cold War context, not cyber warfare, right?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think that we've known and had evidence for quite a number of years that various Chinese hacking sites were making their way into American corporations and, more importantly, well, also universities, think tanks, but more importantly, federal government sites. And, you know, the Chinese have been denying this for years. And as our own efforts to track the hacking have become more sophisticated, we've actually fine-tuned it so we know exactly which building this particular detachment of the People's Liberation Army is working in that's hacking many of these national security sites.
So the question then arises is how autonomous is the People's Liberation Army? There is quite a bit of evidence that the civilian authorities essentially, if they don't control the PLA, they certainly give them everything they want.
Well, I think that there are many, many studies of the question of how civil-military relations are structured in China, and that continues to be a big question mark. I think ultimately when we've seen the deployment of force, usually internally inside China, but sometimes externally, you're able to see at least the command staff and those that report in and around the Politburo and the Standing Committee in China working mostly cohesively, not always, but I think if you look at the pattern of investment in Chinese military forces, the upgrading and modernization, it's keeping pace at a level much, much faster than the explicit growth of the Chinese economy. So they're taking a larger and larger share, if you will, each year of these growth and gains, which are substantial. So it does mean that they have a lot of clout, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the Standing Committee isn't still running the shop. So I don't want to go too far to say the PLA can just do whatever it wants because, the Chinese have demonstrated a lot of strategic restraint at times. And but it is a fascinating equation. We don't know all the details about how that control is maintained.
But in terms of foreign policy, surely somebody in China is affecting the relations with North Korea and North Korea's behavior. It's very difficult to believe that China, who essentially controls the economic lifeline of North Korea, could not have more influence. And the assumption is, and on this part of many, is that the reason that North Korea, that they're sort of playing a game where the foreign ministry is huffing and puffing and condemning the nuclear test, and while the Chinese military are perfectly happy to have a kind of surrogate bad boy on the block.
Well, I mean, I don't want to take this analogy too far, but it's worth thinking about it. And I don't want to defend the Chinese government for what, appears to be, real impotence in dealing with North Korea when they have so many apparent leverage points. But look at the United States in the case of Israel, which is an important partner, is an important security ally, a democracy as well. And yet, when you take a look at the question of who's controlling whom, sometimes it does appear as if U.S. government efforts to direct Israel's behavior this way or that are fairly weak and insubstantial, and that Israel can make its own weather. And I think that relationship probably exists between North Korea and China, that North Korea is able to make its own weather, and it has its own strategic leverage points, and it can get away with a level of recklessness, even with a country like China, because China does worry about migration consequences of North Korea's really failing. It does worry about a direction that would yield a different direction in South Korea. So I don't want to make it sound like you know, North Korea is calling all the shots, but it would be a mistake to just think that because China is so rich, has so much strength, has so many inputs into the North Korean economy, that it's pulling the puppet strings there. I've been in China too many times meeting with elites in the Chinese government when North Korea pulled some antic or another where I can guarantee you they would, you know, that the Chinese government was not tipped off. And there's a funny story. Once when Lee Peng was premier, he invited Kim Il-sung to China to come visit. And he actually wanted to go visit because he just didn't have very much intelligence, according to the Chinese, who wanted to see them. And this led to Lee Peng actually having his trip to North Korea not accepted by the North Koreans, and instead Kim Il-sung made a trip to China and came on that famous iron train down. But that was one of the first times that many in the Chinese leadership had actually met Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il's son, and the current leader's father. So, you know, I think that we need to be careful of just assuming that we think we know that the Chinese must have influence. I think they're frustrated, and the North Koreans, I do think that they have a lot of leverage if they wanted to use it, but they're very similar cases where the United States hasn't used similar leverage on its client states.
And of course, China does not want the U.S. Army on the Yellow River again, which would be the case of a collapse, I imagine, of North Korea.
I think that's absolutely right.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who is a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation and served as executive director of the Japan America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Now, what do you make then of the Chinese warships painting Japanese warships with radar, which seems to have escalated the already somewhat surreal tensions over these little piles of rocks in the South China Sea?
I would say, to be blunt, it's hard to imagine anything scarier than what the Chinese are doing to the Japanese. And it's been fairly remarkable so far that Abe, Shinzo Abe, the new prime minister, has demonstrated such restraint. It took the Defense Forces 2 days to report the painting incident. What we mean is that they're targeting essentially with lasers and targeting Japanese ships for attack. And Abe was told 2 days, and he's demonstrated a lot of strength. He's basically tried to maintain calm, but this was a very, very aggressive action. And I think those people that are worried that miscalculation, a misstep, and the ongoing kind of posturing and rigidity that's building around the Senkaku and Daiyutai, depending on how, you know, which name you prefer to these little islands, is getting ever more serious.
So back to the cyber espionage issue, and it does feel somewhat similar to the Cold War, where there were rules of the road, where right. The U.S. and the USSR were engaged in aggressive espionage, but they only took it so far. And it's clear that there is a distinction between cyber espionage and cyber warfare, and arguably the U.S. has been engaged in cyber warfare with the Stuxnet virus that infected the Iranian nuclear program. Or at least that's certainly an escalation from cyber espionage. What's going on at the White House? The president apparently issued an executive order before his State of the Union. He mentioned cyber attacks in his State of the Union. Obviously, he's been in private contact with the Chinese officials for some time. What do you know about that?
Well, I think they're trying to maintain two things, express displeasure, counter the weaknesses and that the Chinese are prodding and poking in our computer security systems. The president is escalating the threat concerns about that in the White House. And I think they've already had for a while. This isn't new. As you said at the beginning of the show, this isn't a new factor they're zeroing in. And the fact that it's become public is evidence that they're trying to use shame and the press and the media to raise the stakes for how the Chinese appear to the rest of the world. Chinese look like bullies at the moment. They've, you know, in their passports declared essentially all of the South China Sea under Chinese sovereignty. And so when you see these explicit accusations of hacking with such great specificity as to who they're coming from and where they're coming from, and you see the Chinese denials, you're basically seeing the Chinese lose more and more diplomatic ground and sort of the charm ground that it had achieved with all of its investments in much of the world. So, you know, China's just looking like an undependable nation to many, and as a nation that is engaged in duplicity and lies. Not to say that all countries aren't engaged in some of this, but the level and scale of what China is engaging in, the theft, and you get the discomfort very frequently from U.S. firms that are talking about intellectual property theft and problems and unequal access and unfair treatment inside China. And it begins to, you know, boil up into something where people, where I think China is actually losing today more than it's gaining, and that the bubble and the mystique of the, you know, quickly growing China that everybody thought was going to be this new remarkable and different country is looking, we're seeing the nastier side, and that has its own cost for China. So that's, So I don't think we're going to have a war tomorrow over this, but you raise a deeper question, is that the Chinese are engaged in this sort of cyber espionage and, you know, really cyber war. We are as well. And I've kind of told people that to some degree, what's going on there is going to go on in space, and it's going to go on with drones. And you're going to have these new arenas of proliferation of devastating and debilitating capacity. And it really worries me when everyone gets it, not just the big stakeholders like China, Russia, the United States, or the Europeans, but when you get a lot of smaller countries that have drones, that have their own cyber war and cyber espionage programs, and also, as we've seen with the North Koreans and Pakistanis and others, are beginning to probe what they can do in space. So these are the three arenas that haven't been organized well in terms of how you're going to have national competition.
But Steve Clemens, you don't think that there's a cleavage within the Chinese hierarchy in terms of these actions affecting its image and its diplomatic offensive abroad? You know, I don't know that the foreign ministry has a lot of power within the elite, but clearly they must have a different agenda than the military. And I'm just curious to know how that plays out and who's up and who's down.
I think what's going on in China is you've got a posturing among different elites on the civilian side in the Standing Committee and the Central People's Party. You've had people like Bo Xilai be completely crunched out of power. And so what you see is no one standing down, and the traditional lines that we've been able to look at between those who were reformers and those who were a bit more martial in their perspective inside China are harder to see at this moment. I suspect that within the next year or so, you'll see a relaxation of that. But when it comes to issues like domestic unrest, or it comes into questions of China's defense of those islands. In fact, there's a theory out there right now in some among some American analysts that Xi Jinping needs to demonstrate some ability to be tough with someone. And strangely, he may be picking this issue of the Diaoyutai Islands and Japan to demonstrate his strength and his capacity to basically win something. That's very scary if that's true. We don't know if it's true. But I think the old lines, the factions that we traditionally see or suspect that they are around these policy issues are just tougher to see right now because you've just had a leadership transition. A lot of people lost power and were knocked out in this, and nobody wants to look weak. And that is a really, really bad time when you have skirmishes and border disputes and tensions, as we have now, between the United States and China on issues like cyber espionage. No, you know, these other countries like Japan, Europe, India, the U.S. shouldn't acquiesce to China just because it's going through a leadership phase. But it does demonstrate that despite, you know, China's great economic gains, that it continues to be in many ways a strategically immature country that sometimes undermines its own interests when it's maintaining such a martial posture on issues. Because when the United States was distracted in what I saw as self-defeating wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, China was on a global charm offensive. It was investing in big telecom facilities, ports and dams and infrastructure in Latin America, in Africa, and other parts of South Asia. And it was building lots of friends around the world. And it wasn't engaged in these kinds of what seemed to much of the world as power grabs and sovereignty grabs over areas of the world. It was looked at nation with greater magnanimity and self-confidence. That's all gone. So it's all gone in part because of this leadership transition, and because what now many nations, particularly those around China, see is a nation that's muscling everyone, and it's creating a lot of nervousness in the region. That, more than anything else, is one of the reasons why you see in places like Myanmar, Burma, the generals and thugs that were running that government turn a different direction and basically say, you know, China concerns them. So we've seen a lot of rallying of nations just basically concerned about China. And it is a fascinating time to watch. It was something that 2-3 years ago probably couldn't have been predicted.
Well, you mentioned the new leader, Xi Jinping, Steve Clements. He, of course, his father was on the Long March, but nobody since Deng Xiaoping has those kind of credentials from the old Red Army and from the Long March. And my understanding is that at Tiananmen, things did change in as much as civilian leadership got themselves into a situation that they seemed unable to control, and they eventually had to bring in the military. And there's a theory that a kind of Faustian bargain was made there. So do you share that idea?
No, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. They've got basically legitimacy challenges. When you had so many leaders essentially anointed by Deng or had been on the Long March, you had Hu Jintao, Jiang Zemin, and others that essentially were anointed in a line of succession by Deng Xiaoping, that era is over. And so now you've got different factors that are being used to assemble both, you know, a power equation that works for those that ascend in the ranks in China, but you also have these issues like, you know, island disputes and territorial disputes and, you know, claims on, you know, who has more ideological purity this way or that are being manipulated and scrounged for so these leaders can appear legitimate. There's a real legitimacy crisis, I think, brewing amongst, it doesn't mean they're going to fall from power, but it does mean that the certainty that surrounded leadership and its course inside China is eroding rapidly. And now the calculus will be different. And we saw how different it could be as we saw these feuds around Bo Xilai, the personal finances of Wen Jiabao, and others. This was an extraordinary soap opera to watch in Beijing. So that's going to be what we see in the future. More of that, not less.
Well, just in closing, Steve Clements, just back to the cyber espionage aspect and the breaking stories in the last few days, starting with the Mandiant report and the New York Times coverage of that. The White House has decided to share with American Internet service providers the antivirus information that I guess has been developed by Mandiant and others that has the unique signature of these Chinese groups, particularly the People's Liberation Army Unit 61398. And I spoke yesterday with Alan Paller of the SANS Institute, who was talking about how, you know, the Chinese actually have an annual vetting of the cleverest school children in terms of their facility with computers, and they put them all into these organizations, these military units, as like, you know, state-sponsored hackers. And that's, to some extent, the same thing starting to happen here in the United States. So is this giving out the signatures of the Chinese hackers again? Is that going to help?
I think it helps broaden awareness. I think it helps broaden sharing among private sector and the government. Listen, when I lived in Los Angeles years ago in the early 1990s, there was a joint organized crime task force that, interestingly, this included elements of the FBI, the LAPD, other Southern California beast departments, but it also had an intelligence component to it as well, that then became tasked with fascinating watching corporate espionage activities, largely from Asian nations, interested in strategic predatory technology targeting, and very much of it in Southern California. And so in the late 1980s and early 1990s, much of this was coming then from China. And so the notion that this is a new revelation is just silly. It's not at all. But what's happened is you've had a magnificent swelling up of the appetite and sophistication of these espionage activities. And so I think that anything that helps promote government-private sector interaction, and this is a healthy thing because, you know, the Chinese are not just going after U.S. government sites and hacking them. They're going after technology targets to acquire and basically steal technology that they can basically then incorporate both in their, you know, private production, but also their national security production.
Well, Steve Clemons, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clemons, who is the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, he served as executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether there'll be a filibuster to prevent Chuck Hagel from becoming the next Secretary of Defense.
They're programmed to destroy.